You're listening to In the Vault, a KPMG banking industry podcast series.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Liz Lamadou, a principal in KPMG's Banking and Capital Markets Tax Practice. And today I'm joined by some of my transfer pricing and also state and local tax colleagues. And we're going to talk about the implications of transfer pricing and IRC Section 42 on state income and franchise taxes. Welcome, Bree Siciliano, Enrique Martin, both from our transfer pricing tax practice, and Gina Parker from our SALT practice. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you, Liz.
Thank you, Liz.
Great to be here, Liz.
Happy to have you here. So let's get started. At a high level, I think of transfer pricing and Section 42 as allocating income and deductions between related taxpayers in a way to appropriately reflect a taxpayer's income. And usually, you know, transfer pricing is a way to determine arm's length pricing. And honestly, I hear about this most often in the context of international cross-border transactions. Or I guess for non-tax purposes, we also see this in the context of Reg W for regulatory compliance. But I'm really excited to learn more about how this impacts state taxation. But before we dive into state, Enrique and Bree, do you want to give us just a little more introduction to transfer pricing in general?
Happy to, Liz. I can start with the kind of overview of 482. So as you correctly said, 482 gives the IRS the authority to look at those income and deductions among related entities and make sure that all of the transactions are reflecting an arm's length standard. And that's the standard we're always going for. The idea here is that if you're looking at an intercompany transaction, you want to make sure it would be comparable to what you would see if we were dealing with unrelated parties in similar circumstances. So really, this provision is aiming to prevent profit shifting and make sure that taxable income is appropriately reported in the right tax jurisdiction. And Section 482 itself is actually only one paragraph. It's small, but it's the Treasury regulations under Section 482 that provide really detailed guidance on how to properly apply the arm's length standard. And they give you examples of various transfer pricing methods. And as I said, these regulations are extensive. They cover all different aspects of intercompany transactions. So it could be tangible, intangible property transfers, services, cost sharing arrangements. Those are all covered underneath the regulations. And maybe I'll just take 1 minute to talk about some of the key components of Section 482 and the regulations. One is the one you mentioned, Liz. It's that arm's length principle, the arm's length standard. And what we're trying to do here is make sure that any results are consistent with the results that would have been realized if you were uncontrolled taxpayers, right? And they were engaging in the same or similar transactions under the same or similar circumstances. And we typically use comparables for the arm's length standard because identical transactions just aren't available. The second piece is the best method rule, a method that provides the most reliable measure of the arm's length result under the facts and circumstances of a particular transaction is always going to be the preferred method. And finally, comparability. So specific factors should be considered when determining comparability. And these can include functions performed, contractual terms, risks assumed, economic and financial conditions, and also the nature of the property or services transfer. And so when we talk about 482 in that federal context, it's really those are the main concerns that we were looking at.
Okay, great. Thanks, Bree. And then, Enrique, what are some typical intercompany transactions that you see at our banking clients?
I think when we think about the banking world, it is a complex world. So our clients or the big financial institutions are organized in many different ways. They're subject to regulations other than the tax regulations, so banking regulations, which tend to look at the way the different parts of the bank interact with one another. So in a way, they're scrutinized with sort of a transfer pricing lens, not only from a tax perspective, but also from a regulatory perspective. And then there is the operational overlay. And by that, I mean the way in which the banking group may look at its different business units, regardless of whether they sit in different legal entities and how they interact with one another. So to answer your question, we see a whole host of different transactions. So on one hand, we would find some banking groups operate through, for example, service companies. So they have a company that provides services to other banking institutions within the same group that are essentially a service for transfer pricing purposes. But in some instances, it may be services that we don't really observe that easily in the open market. There may be services around provision of IT services, or making some of the platforms and some of the technology that the banks use to operate available to other group companies. So we know that there should be a payment for those services. When we look at the what the regulations, banking regulations say, what the tax regulations say, we have different ways of pricing those transactions. But in general, not that many good comparables out there. So we have to use transfer pricing methods to come up with a price that is that meets the arm's length standard. Then, of course, there are other transactions that are more sort of in line with market, and that's when different parts of a banking group, different legal entities, whether it's a bank and a broker-dealer or different banks, lend money to one another, so the funding transactions. And in those instances, I think it's easier to point to market comparables. We have a lot more information in the market, but obviously those can be pretty significant transactions where we may need to put not only transfer pricing documentation in place, but also explain to the regulators why those transactions are in place, why they're needed, and make sure that we can demonstrate that the pricing is in line with what the group entities would have got in the market. And in between those two sort of extremes, we find all sorts of interactions between the different parts of a banking group that can range from different teams in different legal entities working together on M&A deals or debt capital market issuances, or simply one part of the group raising deposits that are then on lend or used by another part of the group to create assets. So there is a network of transactions, many of which will have direct market comparables, and we will be able to do an analysis to show their arm's length. Some others where we will need to fall back onto transfer pricing methods to show that the transactions are happening in a way that meets the arm's length standard.
So you've described a fairly complicated web, I'll admit. But that makes sense. We've got service type transactions between parts of the bank, funding transactions. We need to look at this with the lens of tax transfer pricing. We need to overlay the regulatory considerations of providing services across the banking organization. And then you mentioned legal entity, which is a perfect segue into state, I think, Gina, because legal entity is always the complicating factor when determining state compliance and filing obligations, because not everyone within a banking organization thinks in terms of legal entity, but we certainly need to understand legal entity for purposes of state. That transition aside, Gina, can you take us through the impacts into state tax of all of these transfer pricing considerations?
Sure, absolutely, Liz. So on the state tax side, we generally see a variety of different ways of which they attack intercompany transactions between banks and non-banks and between the organization itself. And a lot of states, generally what we see is a lot of these are separate company state issues, but they are not isolated to just separate company states. There are certainly more and more combined states that are venturing into this, especially when they're considering transactions with folks outside of their group. The approaches, as I said, sort of vary. You can see the first and foremost, the way they attack it is an approach to attacking it is they challenge the validity of the transfer pricing report itself. This includes a variety of different things, but mostly it's adjustments to ranges in the transfer pricing report itself, provided you have a contemporaneous report or provided you have a report to document the nature of the transactions. This could include a variety of different things, but a lot of what states do is they actually rerun some of the calcs. It's not uncommon for them to throw out various comparables. They can throw out negative comps. They can throw out foreign-owned company comps. They can throw out comps with consistent data, for example, where there's no three-year comp data available. They can also take a view toward just requiring a full add-back or a disallowance of the intercompany transaction itself or a specific charge. The next way we see it is just challenging the business purpose or economic substance. They're very keen on sort of the old way of thinking of looking for tax avoidance planning mechanisms, whether it be around restructurings, formation of those shared service entities where shared services are being performed for members of the group. They want to really look at and show a shifting of profit without a lot of substance. That's really a red flag for them. And that's also where you'll see a lot of documentation requests. So beware of lengthy IDR there for especially around this particular way of attacking and approaching it. They can attack it from an alternative apportionment perspective, where some states look at forced combination, where they combine groups together, where there's a claim of distortion, and they get there under the guise of alternative apportionment. They essentially can thereafter combine separate company income and form of the different entities and form a combined group income. And the only way they say to remedy this is any kind of distortion that's arising here is to use combined reporting, where there's an elimination or some other elimination of all the intercompany transactions itself because of the distortion. They can also look at, just by virtue of alternative apportionment, they can exclude the intercompany receipts itself from the sales factor denominator. They sometimes get there under a matching principle type argument, where the other side of the equation is not subject to the tax in the state. They can't often attack it in that way. The other way they do it is by intangible expense add backs. A lot of these are statutory, but they will certainly scrutinize the documentation around those intangible expense addbacks and make you qualify and or prove significant with significant documentation any exemptions you may claim about that. And lastly, by using any of these approaches, they certainly can look to disallow credits and or NOL deductions as well.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of tools at the state's disposal to attack some of these things. So, and just stepping back high level, we think about a separate company state. We mean where entity by entity files in a jurisdiction. And so I guess the goal of the states, I assume, is to increase the income on some entities or reduce deductions on other entities, or like you said, just make a substance argument and combine everyone together so those intercompany transactions get eliminated.
That's right.
Add in alternative apportionment and distortion. And it sounds like these can be fairly long and drawn out challenges by the state. I'm guessing the documentation requests are extensive.
You're correct.
Yeah. So what are there enforcement trends or other things you're seeing with this?
Absolutely. So recently as well, we've seen states sort of take an evolved approach to transfer pricing challenges. There's been increased scrutiny on transfer pricing studies and the application of the arm's length standard. And we've really seen a growth in this area, especially within the last 5 to 10 years. You've also seen a lot of litigation around it. The main focus is the increased focus on developing the technical knowledge under 482. And what I mean by that is they've really put a lot of investment, they've lawyered up, they've hired transfer pricing experts within the department to really educate them, because this is really a relatively new concept to states, whereas there's been a body of law out there for federal purposes, not as much on the state side. So they're really working toward developing further law, developing further information about it, and by virtue of doing that, you're really seeing a lot of advancement in the links that states go to in these transfer pricing audits. They really began producing in-depth audit reports with respect to the intercompany transactions and the 482 analysis. Several states, that what we're seeing is they're coming up with their own arbitrary distortion ratios, which happen to show obviously large ratios in favor of showing quote unquote distortion, which is in essence caused by a lack of payroll and or a lack of expenses at the entity. Justify that, compare that to the overall taxable income for the entity, and essentially they say the out of state shared service company is really getting more than they really should. Some of that should be attributed to the income and the actual attributes of the entity filing in the state. One of the main things that we've seen is an increasing reliance on contingency fee auditors. I would say in the past decade, more than 20 state revenue departments and the District of Columbia have done several things. They've either contracted with outside transfer pricing experts, which the experts seem to be coming back to a few individuals, and oftentimes you see those individuals. Those are the economists that may testify in a lot of the large state cases. They've executed transfer pricing information exchanges between states. Many of you may be familiar with the Multi-State Tax Commission's State Intercompany Transaction Advisory Service Project. We call it CITES. That was an attempt by a large number of the separate company states to, in essence, share information and try to form a little bit of a unified approach to transfer pricing and how to attack it. It was interesting during that time, and what we saw was that there was audit cycles for neighboring states. What I mean by that is we saw a large number of folks that would receive audit notices from one state, then in a few months they would get an audit notice from the other state. So it was certainly indicative of the states really speaking to each other. As I alluded to before, many of the states have invested in dedicated transfer pricing teams and or they've sent personnel to Section 482 training. What we've oftentimes heard from a lot of those meetings and training sessions is that the various states would be represented there and they would, in essence, use it as an opportunity to share ideas. Hence, some of the audit trends you may see may be duplicated in various states. Various states have also contracted with RoyaltyStat for training, audit support, and access to transfer pricing databases. That, in essence, was a coalition that was led by some economists that, in essence, gave a little bit of a background to and ammunition for the states to go in and attack on a contingency fee basis. With the fact that most of these arrangements with contract auditors are contingency fee based, you sometimes have to scratch your head and just say, does this encourage abuse, which is, again, not taxpayer friendly and we're currently dealing with across a multitude of different states.
That sounds like a lot of activity at the state level, certainly a change from several years ago in this area. With that background on what the states are doing, I want to come back to you, Bree, and talk about what are some practical preparations that a bank tax department can take in this area.
That's a lot of information, Gina, and it's so helpful to understand how states are looking at it when we're trying to get prepared for that audit. And so I think the first thing that I would like to address is making sure you keep your transfer pricing studies current, right? That they're thorough and current, because state auditors are typically going to ask for the same things the IRS would ask for in the beginning. They're going to ask for the report that covers the years under audit. Typically, they're going to ask for legal agreements that are controlling the transactions, and then they're going to ask for, you know, supporting calculations to show that the charges are correct. So making sure that you have transfer pricing documentation and that your documentation shows the business purpose and economic substance. Like Gina said, they're really kind of honing in and making sure that profit shifting is not what you're trying to accomplish with transfer pricing. So the business purpose and economic substance becomes very important. And these studies can be 482 compliant, right? They can be federally compliant as well, but they also have to be reflective of state and local laws to the extent that they're different from 482. And then maybe one final point is it's helpful if you can maintain consistency between any state and cross-border transfer pricing policies or transfer pricing reports. States are able to request your international transfer pricing reports, so consistency becomes very important. And to the extent there are differences in the policies, the taxpayers should certainly be prepared to explain those differences. And then I guess the final point would be understand your local landscape, right? Do local revenue departments engage with a consultant like Gina was talking about? Has the state tax court released any precedential transfer pricing cases? Just kind of understand that landscape. And I think those would be the preparation tips that I would give.
And I guess the other important point is lean into what the regulatory teams may be also looking at, because a lot of these transactions have to be blessed or maybe happen because the regulator mandates them. And those regulators will require disclosure of approaches, calculation of charges, description of the services, a whole host of detail on the transactions themselves, which may be very useful for a state and local tax audit or a transfer pricing audit at the federal level. You will have covered a lot of the bases that the inspectors will be looking at. You will have a detailed description of what is going on, why that is something that the regulator accepts, and what the charge is in terms of how it's calculated, what services it covers, and in general, quite a lot of detail on what goes on behind the scenes. So who's providing the service to whom? What is it exactly intended to be provided, and why it is acceptable from a regulatory perspective? In other words, why that banking institution needs to receive those services and how they fit into their business. So there is a wealth of information floating around the regulatory department for transactions that may not necessarily be covered on the cross-border transfer pricing studies, which will give you a very good starting point to substantiate why those transactions are acceptable and supportable from a state tax level.
That makes a lot of sense. I like all of those practical considerations, especially leveraging everything that's already out there from a regulatory perspective, since we all know banks have to do what the regulators say. So, Gina, any final thoughts on how to defend transfer pricing at a state level and how to win?
So first and foremost, just be prepared, right? Know your company, know the study, know your transactions, and really know the origin and business purpose behind them. It's important to determine if the revenue department engages a consultant. As I spoke to earlier, many of them are actually venturing toward the engagement of an outside consultant. You always want to consider requesting direct access to them to discuss the issues. It's always easier to, in the event they're helping and assisting the state with the audit, it's easier to discuss directly with the consultant rather than using a middleman. You always have to consider privilege waiver issues when you're doing that, but still, in the event it works best, it may be beneficial to talk directly to the consultant. You always want to ask direct questions too about how the states are making the adjustments. Ask the states to identify which transactions are at play here. In those transactions, what do you think the best method in your mind? What would be the best method for determining an arm's length pricing? And how do you make those correlative adjustments to the counterparty when considering that? Always beware of the unreasonable document request and elevate any kind of Department of Revenue attempts to use such requests for leverage. What I've seen is that there can be lengthy IDRs, especially on the business purposes point, where you're looking for reorganizational documents, restructuring documents, such as they may ask for corporate minutes, they may ask for foundational documents. What you oftentimes find is those are sometimes old and cold, and they're very hard to find. So try to have a great conversation with your auditor and sort of navigate what information you is easy to obtain and what's not able to obtain, and sort of work through that with your auditor. Best practice as well on any state tax issue and in audit is always consider legal arguments beyond the transfer pricing rules themselves. Make your protest robust. You sort of throw the kitchen sink at them is what I always think about. And I always like to tell my clients to always pretend they're building a file for litigation. What you want to do is throw any kind of legal arguments, such as whether a state adjustment resulting in double taxing could be challenged on constitutional grounds. States can't really delegate those kind of legal issues to economic consultants, right? They have to bring in their own legal counsel. And probably finally, and probably one of the biggest things to look out for is just think common sense, approach it with a common sense analysis, because some of the outrageous implications of that are sometimes drawn because of the transfer pricing conclusions by the states and by the consultants can sometimes be overcome with common sense analysis around operations and just the overall foundation of the business. Those all present, if you're doing all of that, you're really doing everything you can to really move the audit forward and settle it in the best possible way.
Excellent, excellent advice. So thank you, Gina, and thank you, Bree and Enrique. I love that you guys were here to talk through this. It was really informative and a great new perspective on the other places that transfer pricing is impacting tax. Thanks for talking us through this. And to our audience, thank you for joining us today. This is Liz Lamadue on behalf of KPMG's Banking and Capital Markets Tax Practice. I look forward to talking again soon.
Thanks for listening to In the Vault with KPMG. Be sure to subscribe to this series to be notified of new episodes.